Welcome to the stream. I'm Josh Rush again for Femi OK. The UN says more than 1,000 civilians have been killed in Ukraine since Russia invaded the country a month ago. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden and other NATO leaders have pledged more military hardware to Ukraine while also agreeing to strengthen the military bloc's eastern defenses. Today, we look at what NATO and the EU's next steps mean for people in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. Mykola Vorobyov sent us this video comment about Ukrainian public opinion on the NATO alliance.
Over the last month, Zelensky became a harsh critic of NATO, claiming that the alliance did not support enough Ukraine during the Russian invasion. First and foremost, it did not conduct a non-fly zone over Ukraine. Secondly, because it did not provide MiG-29 needed military jets and anti-missile weapon, including anti-aircraft and so forth. But on the other hand, the support of NATO has increased dramatically, especially over the last month in the Ukrainian society. If before the Russian full-scale invasion it was just about 47%, now it's about 73%.
I'm joined in studio by Al Jazeera senior correspondent Alan Fisher. Hanna Celeste is the director of security programs at the Foreign Policy Council's Ukrainian PRISM. She's in the Ukrainian city of Odessa. And Rania Shaler is a program director in international affairs at Kerber Foundation. She's in Berlin. Oh, yeah, one more seat at the table. Hey, that's you. If you're watching this on YouTube, see that box over there? We have a live stream producer waiting to get your comments to me so I can get them to our guest and you too can be in the stream. Alan, can you give us some of the top lines coming out of the NATO conference in Brussels today?
That's right. A couple of really big meetings going ahead in Belgium over the last few hours and will continue for the next few hours as well. As far as Joe Biden is concerned, the big message is that the United States is ready to accept up to 100,000 refugees into the United States. That will get some pushback from some in Washington. He's called for the removal of Russia from the G20, says that that's a decision to be made by the G20, but clearly he's very keen on that idea. As you said, they're going to strengthen NATO's eastern flank, which probably means more troops to the Baltic countries and also to Poland. And then he perhaps unwittingly suggested there's a gap in his schedule on Friday. He's spending a few hours in Poland. He's going to go and speak to humanitarian workers, but it seems that he may well be looking for an opportunity to meet President Zelensky. From what he said, that's certainly what he was pointing at. That might change because Secret Service don't like the president flagging this sort of thing up. They've been trying to keep it under wraps. But don't be surprised if the two of them meet at some point.
Where would they possibly meet?
Possibly close to the border. I mean, these things aren't left to chance. Secret Service will have been on the ground seeing where there's possibly somewhere that they can meet safely, maybe even in Poland itself, although Zelensky would not be keen on the idea of being seen to leave Poland. But just in the way that Joe Biden almost slipped up, don't be surprised if the two of them meet tomorrow.
And he's known for those kind of slip-ups, honestly, right, if we're honest about it. Rania, so give me your take on this today. Talking about kicking Russia out of the G20, less diplomatic connections with Russia, is that the way forward here?
I mean, we don't know. What we know is that the West has to stand united. And I think today was a very important day for this because we had the NATO summit, we had the European Council going on, but also the summit of the G7 leaders, all of which send a united and a strong message to the world saying we stand with Ukraine. I want to get back to the video you showed in the very beginning where Mykola said Ukrainians have been disappointed with NATO. I think what's important to consider is that NATO members are really treading a fine line between showing support to Ukraine and not giving material for further escalation to the Russian leadership. And this is a very, very difficult situation we're all in.
And President Zelensky addressed NATO leaders today, asking for more of that military hardware. We have a bit of video from that. Can we play his soundbite, please?
Ukraine does not have powerful anti-missile weapons and has a much smaller aircraft fleet than Russia. Therefore, their advantage in the sky is the use of weapons of mass destruction. And you can see the consequences today, how many people were killed, how many peaceful cities were destroyed. The Ukrainian army has been resisting for a month in unequal conditions. And I have been repeating the same thing for a month now. To save people and our cities, Ukraine needs military assistance without any restrictions.
You know, Hanna, Zelensky's been really critical of NATO in the last week or so, but just in the last day or two, is he changing his tone a little bit? And if so, why? What's behind that?
Yes, exactly. If you heard today's speech, the rhetoric changed. He was not criticizing NATO. He was not demanding something. He was not telling that NATO is guilty. One of the reasons is that Ukrainian expert community being quite active trying to explain that don't mix the positions of the individual states with NATO. Don't request from NATO as an organization what it can't provide. Because like weapons that we are asking, NATO cannot provide weapons. Weapons, that is the national government responsibility. So let's ask Germany why Germany doesn't want to do it, or let's ask Hungary why it is blocking certain purchases. But don't tell it to NATO, because what NATO is doing, they did it quite well. And today we heard the change of the rhetoric, both from the president and from the NATO officials, by the way, as well. Because if you heard Stoltenberg for the last 2 weeks, he was telling only NATO cannot do it. And we always said, okay, we know what you can't. Tell us what you can or what you already do. Because definitely NATO been training Ukrainian armed forces. We will not be able to fight as we are doing it now without that 8 years of training. NATO helped with logistics, with the supply chain, with communications, with the cybersecurity, with plenty other things through the trust funds, through the advisors that brought us to the situation we are now. Many countries gave us just 3 days. We are already at the day 28 of this war.
Yeah, Rania, speaking about the way NATO feels about this, a new survey just came out in the last 24 hours, I believe, on how Germans feel about this. And if I can show my computer, we had this survey that shows last year when asked, should Germany stay involved in international crises in the future, you had about 50% say they should be more restrained. So kind of down the middle there, whereas this year, same question, 67% now say that Germany needs to be more involved. This is aligned with the new administration and the greater military spending that we're seeing in Germany. A second question, should Germany become more independent from the United States in its security policy? And right now you have something around 76% saying more independent. So can you suss these two out for me? Because one seems to say more engaged, which would theoretically be through NATO and U.S. be a major part player there. And then three quarters are saying, but do it in a way that's more independent from the U.S.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for bringing this up. I will say a few words about both of them. I think the first one is really significant, and it's a historic shift in German public opinion. So you had these so-called Zeitenwende speeches in the German Bundestag, Germany pledging to really spend 2% of GDP on defense in the coming years, which is significant. It makes Germany the third largest military spender on earth. It's hard to imagine. But what comes with this is really a different, also strategic role in the world. And this will require intense contact and discussion also with the society that has not been used to this. So this change in public opinion is significant, but it will have to be maintained, and it will take efforts from the government to really engage with the society on these questions. Regarding the second graph you showed, you see that a large majority in Germany says they want Europe to become more independent from the United States. And in fact, there was a sub-question asking why, and up to 50% of people said, because we fear that the US will withdraw from Europe in the foreseeable future. So the Trump legacy is still being felt in Europe, but for Europe to really take its fate into their own hands and to become more independent and more active on the world stage, it needs military spending and build up, but it also needs strategic thinking and exchange with partners on this, and there's still a lot of homework to do.
I want to bring in the fourth seat at the table here, YouTube. We have a handful of comments. Alan, I'm going to toss these to you, and maybe we can just do a round robin. Hassan Ishan says the EU has failed Ukraine by not providing enough support. Terrence Correa says why Ukraine cannot become a neutral country. Russia will never be comfortable with NATO on their border. And Andy Warrior says, what are the chances of conflict morphing into World War III?
I think there's an element of relief, which might be too strong a word, that for the moment this war is contained. It's contained within the borders of Ukraine. We're hearing people call for a no-fly zone. That's not going to happen. Joe Biden doesn't want to put Americans directly up against the Russians because then that has the potential to become a much wider conflict. So you're not going to see no-fly zones being implemented at the moment. But if they can continue to support the Ukrainians without directly going up against the Russians, both the United States and NATO are quite happy to do that.
Can I bring up the idea of strategic ambiguity, which means for a nation, rather than drawing a red line in the sand that says, if you cross this, then we escalate, there is no line, and you don't know what the other side necessarily considers an escalation. How calculated is it for the U.S. to know what Russia will consider an escalation?
They've been relatively good with their intelligence up to this point. Remember, before the war, they said, look, the Russians are going to do this, mm-hmm. and the Russians did follow that playbook. What is concerning for the Biden administration is using the phrase red line. If you go back to when Joe Biden was last in the White House, he was vice president under Barack Obama. Barack Obama said, absolutely, a red line. If the Syrians use chemical weapons in Syria, then we're going to take action. Hey, the Syrians used chemical weapons. What did Obama do? Nothing. Then Obama looked weak. Joe Biden doesn't want to give that political advantage away. So you will never, from this White House, hear any senior official say on the record, yeah, there's a red line here.
I want to pull in a quote.
A little bit.
Go for it, Hannah. Go ahead.
Yeah, just as small about the red lines. You know, here you need to understand that sometimes it's not about the actions, but about the perception of the actions. Because as you see now what the Western countries are paying for with weapons and with money, that's because they were so careful as they perceived it and so eager for the dialogue for the previous 8 years since the annexation of Crimea. There are a lot of research now that argue this and saying that maybe if sanctions for the annexation, illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014 would be stronger, probably Mr. Putin will think twice, or at least some oligarchs around him will think twice about sponsoring this project. Because as for now, what we are hearing, like, okay, let's Ukraine become neutral, let's NATO go further, because that is the red lines for the Russian Federation, so don't support Ukraine, and Russia would be nice again. But sorry, Ukraine was neutral in 2014. It didn't prevent Kremlin from actions, and it didn't prevent them 1 month ago. So here it seems to me that sometimes we are manipulating with these issues of red lines for the Russian Federation and what can provoke them, what cannot provoke them. The actions of Mr. Putin and rhetoric of his speeches, especially those who can understand Russian language and can hear the wording and notion that he is using, they became very irrational. They are not according to the logic or some type of the real political bargaining.
Here's what the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, had to say today about this.
So we are resetting NATO's deterrence and defense for the long term, with more troops, with more air assets and more maritime capabilities. We have already increased our presence in the East, and today we decided on 4 new battle groups. And the leaders agreed to task our military commanders to provide options for a long-term reset of our presence, our military posture in the eastern part of the alliance and across the whole alliance.
Rania, when Stoltenberg says that they're going to reinforce the eastern flank of NATO, is he speaking specifically about the Baltic states and that small connection? Here, I have a map. Let's show our viewers a map here. If we can go to my computer. This is NATO. You can see the darker colors still left were the earlier countries, and now it's been encroaching easterly, and it's all the way up into the former Soviet states, the Baltic states, which are connected. And I'm going to put my mouse over this for you guys. That's about a 40-mile border right there, and it's a weak spot in the eastern flank of NATO. So are we talking about moving troops there? And this is starting to sound, I mean, NATO's always been a military organization, but it also kind of feels a little bit like a sleeping giant waking up and forces actually coming into play that have only been theorized for a long time. Can you touch on that, Rania?
Sure. I mean, we're talking about the Baltics, but we're not only talking about the Baltics. NATO already has four battle groups in place in the three Baltic countries, as well as in Poland. That's about where your mouse was hovering. But today, Stoltenberg was announcing the deployment of four more battle groups further in the south of the eastern flank, namely in Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and Hungary, which means that there will really be battle groups from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, so from north to south on the eastern side. And what he means by resetting defense is kind of waking up that sleeping giant that you were talking about. So far what we've seen is a sort of defense by presence. So you knew NATO was there, NATO troops were there, but you didn't really see them. What we are moving to now is something called more defense by denial, or like defense deterrence by actual defense, making clear that NATO will not cede one inch, that's a phrase you might have heard, of its territory.
This is probably the shift today.
Jump in, Hanna.
Yeah, you know, about the Black Sea, the problem being that the NATO didn't have the NATO Black Sea strategy, and we've been arguing for the necessity for the last 10 years at least, even having three literal states as the NATO members. And even when the posture and bigger military presence started to be at the Baltics, still the Black Sea being absent. And the Russian Federation for the last year really increased their actions in maritime domain. We experienced it with the provocations, with the wharf exercises, with the disturbance of navigation. So plenty of activities been happening there. So many countries of the region, especially Romania, been really saying that we need greater presence of NATO here. The same Georgia and Ukraine was insisting NATO finally to decide, is the Black Sea part of NATO or just the neighboring territory? And it seems to me that with this posture of the four additional battle group, NATO finally made a decision that they would like to be present there. That Turkey alone will not be able to front the Russian Federation. Otherwise, you understand perfectly, Georgia left without Navy after 2008 war with the Russian Federation. Bulgarian Navy is very, very weak. And Romania is not bad, but still quite a weak comparing to what Russians had. So as for now, when we have additional forces, and that is additional responsibility for such countries as France, for example, who is moving their aircrafts to Romania, that would mean that finally NATO countries understand the importance of the maritime domain, not less than the eastern flank at the land, the border with the Russian Federation.
Just to pick up on that point, well, NATO will never use the phrase red line. There is a red line. If the Russians go too far, then they will respond. What they don't want to tell the Russians is where that red line is, because there's a concern that Vladimir Putin will push as close as he possibly can to that and try to provoke some sort of reaction. He doesn't want to get involved in a fight with NATO either, so he's got to guess where that red line is. So that puts him slightly at ease.
Clearly,
if
he attacks a NATO state, if military forces cross the line into a Baltic state, that triggers Article 5, and it's a red line. NATO has to respond. But what about something more of a gray area? What about a cyber attack?
Then there could be a response, and that's a way of engaging the Russians if they attack through cyber capabilities, and they're already testing. In the United States. We heard that from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, earlier this week down at the White House. I was there when he said that they're already seeing those tests being made. They're looking for weaknesses. And he said, absolutely, they've said for a number of years that a cyber attack on one could provoke a response from everyone. If there was an attack on a NATO country, it's degrees. If it's just a couple of shots being fired across the border, if it's a mortar round going across the border, will that then bring all of NATO against Russia? Unlikely, because they don't want to escalate this. As I say, it's kind of contained at the moment within the Ukrainian borders.
And it's about more than just the military hardware on the ground. NATO is also about a set of values. I want to bring in a comment from Catherine Wright. She's a senior lecturer in the international politics at Newcastle University.
What we should be looking for is for NATO to uphold and strongly reaffirm the values underpinning the alliance, including human rights, the rule of law, democracy and individual liberty. And that's because this is a war fought by Putin, not just in terms of territorial gain, but in terms of values. And it is that attack on Western values which NATO should be responding to and defending.
We have a comment from Pilo Wise on YouTube that says, what does Putin really want in Ukraine? Alan, he really wants to go after those values, right? After an alliance, a Western alliance.
He wants to see the Western alliance, NATO, the European Union, disjointed, not together. And Joe Biden, to a large degree, when he came into office, said that he wanted to reunite international alliances that had been disrupted by the previous president. And to a degree, he's done that. And you can see that in the way that there has been a united response along the way, in that sanctions have been imposed almost in unison, because he understood the idea that everyone had to be comfortable with the sanctions and they all had to go at the same time so that there was no lag.
We actually have President Biden on that right now. Can we play that back?
Putin was banking on NATO being split. My early conversation with him in December and early January, it was clear to me he didn't think we could sustain this cohesion. NATO has never, never been more united than it is today. Putin is getting exactly the opposite what he intended to have as a consequence of going into Ukraine.
So, Rania, does it seem like Putin has actually made NATO closer and stronger than it was before?
In a way, definitely. I think lots of unintended consequences happened in the West that Putin didn't foresee. It's the unity of NATO. It's all things that happened within the European Union that were unimaginable just 6 weeks ago. Also, the historic shift in German security policy that I mentioned. I want to say one word about Putin's motivations, though. I mean, in the end, we don't know what he wants, unfortunately. I think only Putin himself knows what he wants. But what we do know is that he thinks in historical terms, and part of his mission seems to be to correct some of the what he thinks mistakes that have been made after the end of the Cold War, and that he kind of wants to reunite Soviet states, referring to Ukraine, referring to Belarus, but also to Georgia, Moldova, and others. And this is why this is not only about Ukraine, but this is really about defending the West and defending Western values.
So, Rania, as we all look to Brussels today, wonder what the international community can do. I want to hear from a voice in Ukraine about what they believe the world could do to help. This is Dmytro Shulga. He's a European program director at the International Renaissance Foundation in Ukraine.
The world can help to stop this bloody Russian war in Ukraine by two ways. First way is to help Ukrainian military to crush the Russian military force here by providing Ukraine with modern weapons. Second way is to crush Russian economy by sweeping really devastating sanctions. And without this, it is difficult to speak about finding any sustainable diplomatic solution, because Russian demands are not for compromise, but for a surrender of Ukraine. And their demand for neutrality basically means demand for isolating Ukraine to be left without allies. So it's unacceptable.
Hanna, how does this war end?
We will win and we survive, that's for sure. You need to listen to Ukrainian anthem to understand what is in the DNA. And definitely two words are very important for the Ukrainian identity, that is freedom and dignity. And that was very difficult to understand to Mr. Putin, because honestly, like you ask what Mr. Putin wants, I would say that there are three things. To humiliate NATO, we definitely see it from his statements. To restore the Soviet Union, but in some crazy mix of Soviet Union and Russian Empire. And the third one is just to... how to say it in the polite words, but to crash Ukrainian identity and sovereignty, because that's been really crazy for him, how racist his statements about Ukraine, Ukrainian statehood, always been. So when you unite these crazy paranoidal wishes of Mr. Putin, you understand that for Ukraine will be important not only military support and economic sanctions that Dmytro perfectly described, but also one very important thing, for the Western countries to believe in Ukrainian. To trust of what Ukrainians are telling about this situation. Because in the beginning of the war, do you know what was the biggest fear of Ukrainians? Not the mighty of the Russian army, but that our Western partners would make us to surrender because they will be afraid of the Kremlin and the actions of the Russian armed forces.
All right, Hanna, I got to end it there. Thank you so much for that final thought. That's all for today. I want to thank all three of my guests for joining me on the stream. And for you, too, who joined us from YouTube, we'll see you next time.